This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is the former MTV VJ and current Fox News personality, Kennedy. She emerged in the 1990s as a leading voice of Gen X when it came to politics and culture. I talked with her about how a generation raised on neglect, nuclear nightmares, and Nirvana forged an ethos of irreverence and independence that still matters today. She explains her evolution from a teen Republican who swooned over Dan Quayle to a principled libertarian. Why the culture of alternative music and media once felt so alive and vital, and what it means when former pop culture rebels like Jimmy Kimmel and Howard Stern become defenders of the status quo. She also talks about free-range parenting and why more of us need to stop caring about what others think and let everyone live radically on their own terms. Here is The Reason Interview with Kennedy.
All right, so we know the names, right? The single-named beings that stride our planet, like Latter-day Gods, Madonna, Prince, Sting, Bjork, Liberace, and, of course, Kennedy, my guest tonight. Kennedy, thanks for talking.
Thank you, and thank you, Nick Gillespie.
Yeah. I'm not sure which name I want to get. Should I get rid of Nick or Gillespie or come up with something new?
Evita's up for grabs.
Evita, yeah. Right? Let's talk about the early days of Kennedy as a public figure. You started working at MTV around 1992?
Correct.
Okay.
It was September of 1992, right before Bill Clinton was elected.
Yeah. And now I want to spend a lot of time talking about Gen X. And even though I am a part of the baby boom, I've become possessed with the idea that Gen X is the best generation. And its characteristics are what we need in America today. But before we get to that, because you mentioned Bill Clinton, and that was the big generational shift. He was the first baby boom president.
Yes.
Can you paint a scene? What was it like at MTV when Bill Clinton won the presidency?
It was so hopeful. People were so optimistic in New York. And of course, MTV at the time was populated by, it's like kind of East Coast elites, big city liberals. A lot of people had gone to places like, Yale and Dartmouth and a lot of Emerson University graduates at MTV. And they were ready.
So a lot of miming in the hallway.
Moment chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were ready for their president.
Yeah.
And so the MTV News Department, which was fairly new and gaining influence at that time, they were putting a lot of money and a lot of resources into MTV News and wanted to cover the political campaign in a new way for this generation who were just interfacing with politics and news for the first time. And so when Bill Clinton was elected, they didn't really pay attention to the data. They just looked at everything and looked at all the coverage and publicity that the Choose or Lose campaign got. And they were like, well, MTV elected Bill Clinton, and you are so welcome. Yeah. And so, then they really took, they didn't talk about Ross Perot. They didn't talk about the 12 years of the Reagan-Bush era. It was just like, well, no, MTV was here and ordained Bill Clinton as president. And now, it was a massive shift.
You were, it's hard to recover that. And I think we're going through something similar now, which will probably fully come online in a couple of years, but where it's the first millennial president or something. But you were the resident Republican at MTV. So what were you thinking? Why were you a Republican, and what did that mean to you?
I was a Republican because I grew up in Oregon where everyone was liberal, and the people who were really into politics didn't seem particularly happy. And there was a kid at my high school named Creighton Webb who was the president of the Teen Republicans. And he invited me to go to a couple of chapter meetings. And then he invited me to meet Dan Quayle Portland when I was a senior in high school.
And you famously kind of splooged over Dan Quayle, didn't you? He was a handsome, robust young man.
I'm not going to say that it was externally ejaculatory, but I will say that I felt like there was such a connection between us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think when you feel a connection like that, and any stalker can co-sign this, like, it can't be one-sided. When you feel something that deeply and that intensely with another human being for another, I mean, obviously they feel the same thing for you.
Yeah.
Like there's that famous Mookie Wilson fake quote that, you know, whenever I'm going through a slump, I just think about dinosaurs. And then I think if I'm thinking about dinosaurs, then somewhere the dinosaurs are thinking about me.
Yeah.
And if the dinosaurs believe in me, then I can believe in me. And all of a sudden I feel better. Yeah. And it's a totally fake quote, but it's one of my favorite things in the world. So that's how I felt about Dan Quayle.
So what was beyond being contrarian? What was the appeal of being a Republican though?
I mean, it really was at that point in my kind of immature developing brain, it just made people so mad.
Yeah.
And so I had this one
this
English teacher.
This is a great part of Gen X, right?
Yeah. Like I mean, I had this one English teacher who was such a blowhard, and he was such a liberal. And he talked about like going to Tibet and throwing himself naked on the side of a mountain. And he failed me, and I hated him with a blinding passion. And the thing he really hated about me was I started cavorting with the teen Republicans.
Yeah.
And they were really fun. And they were just like rabble rousers. And I compare it to young men in high school and college today who wear MAGA hats. Mm-hmm. Like they don't necessarily believe in like the Trump doctrine, whatever that means for them. But they just know like they're constipated, liberal, social studies teacher in high school. Like it gets nothing makes them seethe like this. Yeah. And there's something really satisfying about that.
Right.
And I think there has to be something utilitarian about making people you don't respect that angry.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure, I'll put that in terms of evolutionary biology where, you know, the people who did that did not get eaten by the lions or something. I don't know. But you then evolved and you evolved upwards and to a libertarian position, partly because of the people that you met at MTV. Can you talk a little bit about what took you from being a kind of oppositional or a contrarian Republican to a self-declared libertarian?
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff that I liked about the Republican Party in 1992 and 1993 because it became the opposition party. But what I didn't like about it was I had a lot of gay friends, especially being in New York, being young, being in music. And I didn't like the way that, you know, because Jesse Helms was still alive and, you know, one of his famous quotes was, "You become what you condone." And I'm like,
"Oh wow!
I don't think I'm going to become a gay man anytime soon.
Oh, well, you've still got some time
left. But right now,
left.
Like, I totally could. Yeah. I could be like, tomorrow, like, I'm a gay man. Yeah. They'd be like, great, we're going to throw you a parade. Congratulations. but the social conservatism was really off-putting, but I liked the idea of aspirational success. Mm-hmm. And so I was having dinner with Kurt Loder one night, and he was like, "You're not a Republican." And he was getting really frustrated, but he was very angry about the Clinton White House, and he was disgusted about what he saw as like encroaching big government.
Right.
And I was like, "I hate that stuff too." But he's like, "You're a libertarian." And I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
But I was very intrigued by the idea because I was also very good friends with Dweezil Zappa, and we would sit and talk with his father, Frank, who at the time was being treated for metastatic prostate cancer. And, you know, he would lose his battle with that the year after I met him. But, you know, it's like listening to Frank, because we wouldn't talk because I didn't have a lot to add to the discussion. But listening to Frank, because
I get the impression, too, that Frank Zappa didn't really need people to fill the pauses.
No, he didn't. No. He was a talker, very interesting person.
Yeah.
Loved coffee.
Yeah.
And he talked about libertarianism, and he was really interesting the way Kurt Loder was really interesting. And they both were like energized and super powered by music. Obviously, Frank Zappa was creating music in a way that no one ever had. And musicians that I love respected him so much. And Kurt Loder analyzed and understood music in the way a critically thinking journalist would. And he didn't have to make music to really want to exist inside of it, take it apart, and explain it to people. So if both those people who were infinitely smarter and more experienced than me, if they had come to, if they had a name for the same kind of conclusion, and one of them was saying, you're a libertarian as well, then I wanted to investigate that and see what
you,
that meant.
You have mentioned that Kurt gave you an Ayn Rand book.
He did. And yet, I still have it. I rescued it.
And you became a libertarian regardless.
I rescued. So I have a home in Pacific Palisades that is uninhabitable. It is filled with lead and asbestos. And the insurance company is trying to deny our claim. Mm-hmm. And everything around us burned. Everything, like three houses in either direction. Everything around us burned. The back door blew open. And that means that every microwave, every piece of siding, every Tesla, everything in the neighborhood burned. And the incineration and the aftermath filled our house as it did with the people who were fortunate enough to keep their homes. And pretty much everything in the house has to be thrown away. And there were two books that there are three. It was like a really, really old edition of Les Miserables in French. And Emmanuel's like, oh, mon Dieu, c'est fantastique. and then one was, of course, I found the copy that Kurt gave me of Objectivist Epistemology. And then the other was a book called You Are the Message. And I had it autographed by the author in 1993 when he and I were co-panelists on one of the earliest episodes of Politically Incorrect that at the time was on Comedy Central. And the inscription on the book is, Dear Kennedy, I think you're fantastic. Do you fool around? And that book was written, wait for the punchline. That book was written by Roger Ailes.
Wow. Yeah. What?
And no, I didn't fool around.
Yeah.
There was no fooling around. And as Mary Catherine Hamm pointed out years later, he didn't really have a thing for quirky libertarian brunettes.
Yeah. No, that's not his type. Right?
No.
What was it about libertarianism that appealed to you then?
Freedom, the freedom to be successful, the freedom to make academic inquiry without being married to groupthink, and the freedom to allow people to do whatever they wanted, because I saw so much of that going on around me in music. And as long as it didn't affect me, you know, there was a relationship between debauchery and creativity that I always found so fascinating. Like that intersection was so rich because it could be chaotic and destructive and deadly, or it could be mind-blowing and soul-shaking and beautiful. And, you know, a lot of the social conservatives, they did condemn that. And, you know, they condemned music, they condemned lyrics, and they condemned partying of any kind. And even though, you know, I was really straight edge at the time, I loved being around people who rode the razor's edge.
Was there, you know, did the people in the music industry or in the entertainment industry, where they wanted creativity, they wanted freedom to create, but then their politics tended to be the most suffocating form of, well, I should be allowed to do what I want, but you have to turn your thermostat down. You have to drive this kind of car. You have to work this kind of way. Did people, like, how does that kind of cognitive dissonance maintain itself?
I think that it sort of dies for a little bit and hibernates, and then it comes back. It comes back as Occupy Wall Street, and now it has regenerated and reanimated as the Squad. Yeah. And so you see this progressivism, which obviously wants to increase the size and power of the state, but at the same time, there's an edict. There are these arbitrary rules that you must live by. And if you're not, you're the other, you're a bad person, and you must be conquered and crushed. And, you know, it's like, you can't go on private jets, you can't build skyscrapers, you can't use gas stoves, but
I'm going to cook a video on Instagram Live, and it's going to be on my gas stove because I'm so amazing. Let's celebrate the global intifada.
Yeah. you know, the show that you...
That's Chuck Schumer, by the way.
Yeah. I'm glad somebody knew who that was.
Yeah.
The show that you hosted on MTV, I mean, you were on a bunch of things, but it was called Alternative Nation. One of the things that was kind of great about the 90s was that alternative music became mainstream. It was the mainstream. There was no mainstream anymore. There was a period of time where things that were labeled alternative were the best-selling type of music. And throughout the culture, there was a real celebration of kind of people hiving off and experimenting and doing their own thing and kind of, you know, moving away from the old gods and creating new gods and then smashing those idols and moving on. What do you think went into that? And, you know, is that something that we should be striving to recapture?
I don't know if you can recapture it because so much of what people do is just to be seen. And so much of what was great about that scene was like dudes who now would be called incels locking themselves in garages and basements and just experimenting with chords, you know, and putting their sad poems and their quirky poems to music. And then, you know, getting together with a couple of friends, like, screw it, you know, let's go play an open mic night and, you know, see if we can get anything going at this bar. And then slowly and organically building a following, and then you tour, you know, you get a crappy van and you start driving around the country and you're sleeping on friends' floors. And then the second time around, your van's a little bit bigger. And there, it turned out that there was such an appetite for, you know, that sort of isolated and beautiful creation that it just, in spite of itself and in spite of being just repulsed by fame, absolutely exploded and became its own monster that that could not be killed or tamed.
This puts me in mind of the story that you've told me that you were prank phone called by Kurt Cobain.
Yes.
Of Nirvana. What was the nature of the prank phone call?
So Pat Smear and I were friends, and Pat was...
He was the touring guitarist for Nirvana. He's now in the Foo Fighters and was in the great LA punk band, The Germs. Which burned too brightly. Yes. Let's put it that way.
And so Pat and I became friends, and Kurt was like, "You have her number?" And Pat's like, "Yes." And he's like, "Let's prank call her." And Pat's like, "No, she's my friend. I can't." And Kurt's like, "I'll fire you from the band." And he's like, "Okay, here it is." And but at the time, I got prank called by so many people that I was so used to getting prank calls that, you know, someone call him, you know, be like, "Is your refrigerator running?" And I'm like, "Yeah, and your mom's balls are in it." And I would like prank the people right back. And so I did that with him and he didn't know what to do.
And so he was so sensitive.
Very sensitive.
Yeah.
So he hung up and we know how everything ended. And I blame myself.
Wow. Towards the end
too
of...
Too soon. Yeah.
I think Kurt Cobain would be the first person to say it's never too soon. Right? So, I don't know.
Courtney Love gave out my phone number one night on stage. And for that, she's a filthy crack whore because I had to change my number. But at the time, it took so long to get your number changed that I had to spend a week taking calls like, "Courtney, give out your number." So my outgoing message was like, "Hello, you have reached Dr. Rothbaum plastic surgery for the energetically ugly. Please leave your message at the tone."
It was a simpler time, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah. Before we continue with the Reason interview, I want to tell you about the Future of Freedom podcast. If you're tired of cable news debates and Twitter shouting matches, and you're looking for serious good faith conversations between people who actually care about liberty, then it's time to check out the Future of Freedom podcast. Each episode dives deep into a single topic: tariffs, campus speech, DOGE, and it brings together two guests who disagree on the best way forward. But here's the twist. This is not a debate show. There's no interrupting and there's no dunking. Each guest, whether libertarian or conservative, has to make their own case, not just tear down the other side. It's compelling. It's civil. It's genuinely challenging. You'll hear familiar Reason voices like me, Stephanie Slade,
and Joe Lancaster on it, alongside other principal thinkers on the right and center right, each bringing sharp ideas to the table. So if you believe the future of freedom depends on more than just winning arguments, and you're ready for something deeper than the usual echo chambers, check out the Future of Freedom podcast. Real disagreement, real ideas, real conversations. Subscribe to Future of Freedom wherever you get your podcasts. That's Future of Freedom. And now, back to the Reason interview.
At the end of the 90s, you wrote a book called Hey Ladies! Exclamation point, which was advice for young women at the time. What was the main message of that, and do you think it still holds up?
The main message was try not to get boob jobs or give too many blow jobs and earn as much money as you can and just get rad. And then if that doesn't work out, go become a nun. Okay. That was the message. I mean, it really is like, it's all about like, you know, don't disfigure yourself. Like, you're really beautiful no matter what. And you can still get herpes from mouth love.
Yeah. I think we've solved that problem. Nobody talks about herpes anymore, right?
You know? That was like, so I have teenage daughters, and that was how I scared them. Because I really think, like, my mom's Romanian, and, like, guilt and superstition are such phenomenal tools that parents are so worried about being friends with their kids now that they don't use them effectively. But I told my daughters, like, okay, if a boy is going to put his penis in your mouth, he has put it in another girl's bottom, and there are butthole warts that you can actually get in your throat. Yeah. So just be careful. Just think about that.
Okay. Wow. Now I understand why, you know, Gen Z doesn't have sex.
Right? Exactly.
You were a kind of professional virgin for a while when you emerged, a Republican and a virgin.
Was it for a lack of trying? But yeah, that's true.
Yeah. What was the, you know, what was being a public virgin about?
It was about being obnoxious and not being able to seal the deal. So it wasn't like, I'm just going to wait forever. It's like, no, seriously, anyone, literally anyone. You, no. Jay Maskus, no? Okay, very good. So I guess I was the incel.
Yeah.
But no, it was, so my name on KROQ, which was the radio station where I
K-Rock.
Started, which became a feeder station for MTV because Adam Carolla and Jimmy Kimmel started there. Carson Daly started there. Louis Largent, God rest his soul, who was the music director when I was there, he went on to host 120 Minutes at MTV. Yeah. Our program director, Andy Schoen, who got hired at MTV in the spring of 1992, hired us all and brought us over one by one. So when I was on K-Rock at the time, like I had not had marital man-woman relations. And we're trying to come up with a radio name because, you know, it's like you have to have a quirky radio name. Like our morning show is Kevin and Bean. It's like, it's Rocktober 2 for Tuesday, folks. Be funny or be quiet. Be better than the music.
Yeah.
So you had to have like a kitschy radio name. So they were like, how about the Virgin Kennedy? I was like, well, it fits.
Okay. There you go. When did you drop that?
The Virgin Kennedy when I got to MTV because Andy thought it was really funny. Everyone like the Emerson suits at MTV were like, no, that's stupid. That sounds like a radio name. This is not radio.
No, this is MTV.
Yeah, this is MTV.
Right? Yeah.
Go get some conditioner in your hair.
What what were your favorite bands in the MTV period? Oh. Like who were the ones that you would die for?
Die for. Rocket from the Crypt, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Okay. Like the entire 90s San Diego punk rock scene, I think, is one of the most perfect eras.
Wait, Rocket from the Crypt from
San Diego.
San Diego,
yeah.
Or not Cleveland?
No, Rocket from the Crypt was from San Diego, California.
Okay.
Along with Drive Like Jehu, Olive Lawn, Pitchfork, like they were amazing. I have a Rocket from the Crypt tattoo.
I'm sorry, I was thinking of Rocket from the Tombs. Excuse me.
No,
the Cleveland.
Yeah.
Wait, excuse me.
I'm
having a senior moment here. Yeah.
That's okay. Maybe that's where they took their name. But I have a Rocket from the Crypt tattoo. So in the 90s, if you had this tattoo, you could get into all their shows for free.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, we want MTV to play our music, so we would let you in for free anyways, hoping that you put in a good word with your bosses. But I didn't know that, so.
Yeah. So What?
How and I loved Mudhoney as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Hmm. And Rancid.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you done?
And I guess we could think of things all night. I wasn't wild about Pearl Jam.
No? Why not? What didn't you like about Pearl Jam?
I felt that they were so pissy and like, we don't want MTV. We don't want to do anything on MTV. We're so cool. And we're in flannel. And then I sold my house to Stone Gossard. And now I really like Pearl Jam.
Yeah. I like the way that in the name of not selling out, they always made it more complicated for their fans to buy tickets.
Yeah, exactly.
And things like that. Because they wouldn't use Ticketron. Fuck Ticketron or Ticketmaster now. Right?
Yeah, now
instead,
they play
go out
like,
and stand in line in the middle of the night somewhere.
Yeah, now they play arenas in South America and make $20 million a show.
So talk a bit about the Gen X ethos. You know, part of it is being contrarian, part of it is being against whoever is in charge. Mm-hmm. Part of it is being DIY. How did that play out in your early career and in your life?
So I think I've always thought that Gen X was really amazing and fascinating because, and I remember having this discussion with one of the executives at MTV. He was only a few years older than me, maybe like 6 or 7 years older. But, you know, we had disagreements about why our generation was the way it was. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it's because like we lived under the threat of nuclear holocaust. Like we always thought, you know, like Sting singing like, I hope the Russians love their children too, because they're going to kill us any day. Get under your desk. No. And, you know, we always just assumed that we were going to die in a nuclear holocaust. And so, you know, it's like either you're nihilistic and you're like, well, then I have nothing to live for, or dude, we're going to die in any second. Yeah. So let's go light some shit on fire.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, those were the people that I grew up with. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, let's sneak out and teepee someone's house and then go see a rock show. And, you know, just because part of it was the fear of imminent destruction. And the other part, which I always thought was so curious, was just like total neglect. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's like your mom would leave you with a loaf of Wonder Bread and a brick of Velveeta and call it good. Mm-hmm. And you were, you know, it's like we were all latchkey kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of kids, especially in the late 70s and 80s, their parents got divorced and they abandoned the 50s as fast. Like they ran for the exits.
Right.
So they had these like traditional upbringings with aprons and apple pie. And the second they could be like, okay, you guys just come home at night and we kind of don't give a shit what happens to you at all. And that's how we were raised. Like we were mongrels. We were little heathens, you know, just like trying to piece stuff together. And I remember so much my childhood was like coming up with elaborate pranks that really disturb people, throwing things at cars and lighting things on fire.
Yeah.
And my dad, every 4th of July, would give us a bag of fireworks and each of us a lighter and was like, go have fun.
Yeah.
And it's like, that, and now I look back and it's like, part of me thinks it's neglect and part of me thinks our parents were actually trying to kill us.
Yeah.
Like, go all get on your bicycles and ride around and try and find a rabid dog.
Yeah.
And you don't have cell phones. You have no way of communicating.
What?
And if one of the neighbors hits you, one of their parents, I'm good with it.
Yeah. No, they're probably right.
Yeah.
What, did you raise your kids that way? Or are you raising your kids that way?
You know, kind of. Like, I love the idea of free-range parenting, mm-hmm. but it still scares the crap out of me being in New York because, you know, as parents who grow up with kids in the city, like, they see things constantly. Like, they're always like, I saw a guy pooping on the subway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I saw that, like, 3 times last week. Like, that's such a boring story. Please come up with something new. And then, like, the other night, my daughter and her friend were in a cab, in a yellow cab, and the cab driver locked them in the cab. And then they had the wherewithal to call my handsome teenage boyfriend and texted him, pretend you're a cop. And he answered the phone and my older daughter was like, you're a cop, right? And he, in his authoritative voice, convinced the cab driver to unlock the cab. He then got out and chased them. And then luckily a deli owner came out and intervened and, you know, offered to pay the cab driver money. And then they had to call the cops.
Was
and
the cab driver, like, was he completely unmotivated in this? Or what was going on with your daughters? Or your...
I mean, you know, it's like they were probably asking for it.
Yeah, I'm just, it's very strange.
I'm kidding. No, but but these are the things like you want to be like loosey-goosey,
right.
Lenore Skenazy and be like, I just let my kids ride the subway from the time they're 4 months old.
Right.
You know, it's like if there are people around.
They should
be
driving
cabs
by the time they're 13, right?
Exactly.
Forget about being on the subway.
Driver's licenses are a societal convention. Yeah. Like we don't really need any licensing.
No.
But yes, in a way, yes. Like the most freeing thing as a parent was when I could finally start swearing in front of my children, because then I felt like I could be myself and they finally could know me.
Yeah.
And then I was telling Joanna and Emmanuel earlier, you know, cause we're talking about a group of parents talking about progressivism in New York schools. And I was like, well, my daughter goes to a public school. And another parent was like, it doesn't matter where they go. Like, it could be a private school. It could be an upscale private school. They're all progressive. Mm-hmm. Their minds are all warped. And, you know, I always say that my children were saved when they started watching South Park.
Yeah.
And they realized, like, it's fun to swear. It's fun to make fun of everything. And nothing is sacred. Yeah. So
how do you... turn that nothing is sacred and, you know, having fun. This is a great Gen X dimension, right? Of just making fun of everything all the time. Does that become corrosive, or how do you turn that into where you actually stand for something as opposed to just constantly be knocking things down?
I mean, you can make fun of everything, and that's what makes it safe. You know, it's sort of the antidote to cynicism. Like cynicism is awful. Cynicism and I should say bitterness, like those are the corrosive elements. And I think that comes from, you know, this stasis where you're constantly angry about everything and you're utterly joyless. And that's, you know, you look at the world and everything is bad and everyone is horrible and you should feel very guilty for everything. That's the opposite of, you know, let's have some fun. Let's make fun of everything. And, you know, of course you have to point that lens at yourself.
Right.
And, you know, self-deprecation is also very, very powerful and a bonding experience when everyone can just roast each other. Like, what would you rather do? Like, watch the roast of David Hasselhoff or go to a Bernie Sanders rally?
Yeah. I'm going to go with David Hasselhoff.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Even if he's eating burgers off the floor.
It's kind of sexy.
Nice. Yeah.
You know, it's,
oh, it's like,
it's,
you know,
keto.
Yeah.
It's maha.
Yeah, that's right.
Probably bison.
If we come to the current moment, where has that ability to make fun of everything gone? Because it seems like on the left, certain things are sacred and can never be talked about. And now, particularly with the re-election of Donald Trump, the same thing. Like, nobody is afraid within kind of the Trump wing to make fun of Trump.
Yes. And make fun of everything. Because, you know, the thing that bummed me out were Sarah Silverman and Amy Schumer apologizing for their acts. And I was like, how dare you? Like, to me, that was almost like heresy. Mm. Like, the jokes that you created that were so outlandish, you know, and that's how you establish your name. Now you are distancing yourself from the humor that, you know, made you what you are, like that was your identity, like the ability to pointedly say anything and make fun of anyone. And they're like, oh, well, we shouldn't say that. And like one of my heroes, Howard Stern, like what he has become and being consumed by political correctness, it's so sad to see. And him apologizing for, you know, bits that he did in the 80s and 90s.
Right.
And it's like, sure, they're off color and gross, but it's like, it, you know, at least give yourself the dignity to acknowledge that that's where we were at that time. Like, that's how people made each other laugh.
What do you, with somebody like Howard Stern, who is, you know, I mean, just really transformed radio and a lot of other kind of talk media because of that. And he had a couple of great interview shows on like the E! Channel. And he did a New Year's Eve special with, among other things, Sherman Helmsley from the Jeffersons, which is now like nobody talks about it.
Yeah.
And it was remarkable. It was pay-per-view. And I have a VHS of it somewhere slowly turning into vinegar. And it's beautiful. What happens with people like that, where they go from being the person who gives no fucks to the person interviewing Joe Biden and coaching him through his answers?
Yeah. It's, when did he become Eva Braun? No, but, you know, the point is, like, the old Howard Stern would point out Joe Biden's dementia and, you know, probably have, like, Sal and Fred and everyone else, like, writing funny bits about how Joe Biden, you know, was pooping his pants in the Rose Garden. But, you know, now that he is this cultural codependent, it says a lot. And it says a lot about the people that they surround themselves with who make them feel like unless they abide by this progressive orthodoxy, they're bad people and they're to blame for everything. And they sort of buy into it. Jimmy Kimmel's the same way. Mm. Like Jimmy Kimmel and Adam Carolla are still best friends, but they have completely diverged from one another.
This is like the old movie Angels with Dirty Faces, where Jimmy Cagney gets caught by the cops and goes to prison and becomes a gangster, and Pat O'Brien becomes a priest. Talk a little bit about that. That's kind of an interesting.
Do you mean the Pat O'Brien from Access Hollywood?
I don't mean Pat. No, he was no priest, let me tell you. But Pat O'Brien, the old moon-faced actor.
Do you remember when Pat O'Brien, when that tape came out?
Absolutely.
He drove by me, and I started screaming lines from that tape. And he accelerated. He must have been doing 85 and a 20.
And he was probably drunk to the gills, too.
Yeah. And, you know, but probably had a little bit of Brentwood speedball before he showed up.
What happened with Adam? You know, what happened that Adam Carolla went one direction and also did not just, I'm not going to say true to something, but he also created this vast alternative podcast media empire. Jimmy Kimmel hits the jackpot in the old legacy media thing. Can you just kind of talk a little bit about?
Yeah. So do you remember the Nicole Kidman movie To Die For?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Nicole Kidman, like her whole thing, she was a local newscaster and she just wanted to go network. Yeah. She wanted, and she literally would have
and
killed her own
mom. And she didn't
care
who got in her way.
Nope. Yeah. She was just going to do, and that was Jimmy Kimmel. So he went the Nicole Kidman route and was like, you know, I'm going to appeal to the suits at Disney and ABC. I'm going to sanitize my comedy and my image and get a hair system. And and Adam was just like,
I mean, they were on The Man Show.
The Man Show.
Right?
So
which
Jimmy Kimmel made his name watching girls jump on trampolines so they could see their boobs bounce. Like, that's how he made his name. It's like, how could you abandon that? Where are your principles, sir?
Wow. He's going to wake up one day and wonder where it all went.
Yeah.
What about Adam Carolla?
I think Adam is a genius. Mm-hmm. And I think Adam saw past radio because everyone at the time was like, oh, we got to get Howard stations. Like, if we get Howard stations, you know, we're going to be worth $100 million in a couple of years. Yeah. But Howard leaving Sirius just accelerated the push into new media. Can I tell you a really funny story very quickly?
I don't think we have time for it, but okay.
So Andy, who was my program director at MTV, who hired us all to go to MTV, a few years after he left MTV, he was a general manager at Warner Brothers Music, and then he was in charge of something called Press Play, which I think was a music device at Sony. And so, and he always kind of had his eye on new media. Very smart guy. Same way as Carolla. And so Steve Jobs is like, you know, I want to meet with you. I want to talk to you. I want to see if maybe you'd be a good fit for us here at Apple. And so Andy went and met with him and, you know, spent 3 hours in this glass office just waiting. And he could see Steve Jobs like going up and down the hallway, like talking on the phone. He's like, and it was like a form of psychological torture. And he was like, well, this is odd. And so finally he goes in and he meets with Steve Jobs. And so Steve Jobs has his resume, God rest his soul, visionary, pioneer. So he's looking at Andy's resume going, shit, this is shit. That shit, 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 shit. He's like, Jesus, man, everything you've done since MTV is shit. And he's like, you know, do you have anything new for me? And Andy was like, yeah, actually, I've always had this idea that, you know, listening to someone on talk radio shouldn't be something that you only listen to a certain hour of the day when it's broadcast, but what if there's a talk radio person and you really like what they're saying and you sort of listen to their monologue like a song, and then, you know, you could carry it around with you and an iPod. And Steve Jobs like, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. Mm. Wow. And a couple months later launched podcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's talk about at Fox News now.
Adam was the same way. Adam's like, don't chase Howard's ghost.
Right.
Create your own thing. And he knew he wanted to have conversations in a way, and he knew he was convinced. Adam Curry's the same way. Like, they were convinced that they could talk to people the way they wanted to talk to them in a longer format and not be chained to the radio clock, which is, okay, we're out at 58. It's a hard out. You know, it's like traffic and weather together
on
the ones.
You got to speed up at the end and cut people off and all that. You've been at Fox News now for, when did you join Fox?
2012.
Right. And you did a number of shows, including The Independents with Reason Zone, Matt Welch. And then your own show, Kennedy. Now you're on The Five and you're on a variety of other shows. And you do Kennedy Saves the World. Is that through Fox?
That's a Fox News podcast.
What does it feel like? When Fox created its network in, 96, I think, something like that. That was kind of cutting-edge new media, cable news. I mean, CNN had been around and MSNBC was floating around. But now cable is kind of the old media, right?
Yes.
How does it feel to have started at MTV, which was kind of an upstart, and now you're at the kind of Cadillac brand of cable news? And I mean Cadillac not only in the sense that it's the best, but it's the best in terms of, like, somebody in the 1950s thinks, oh, the Cadillac. Nobody talks about wanting the Cadillac of anything anymore. How does that feel? I mean, do you feel like you're in some kind of loop or something? I mean, what's it like to be at legacy media now?
I mean, it's fascinating because Fox is putting a lot of emphasis on Fox Nation, which is their digital space, and it's a subscriber space, and Fox Digital, and the podcasts, which, you know, podcasts, as you know, are video now. They're not just auditory experiences.
I'm waiting for them to become olfactory, and then it's a triple threat. Right?
Listen and sniff.
Yeah.
With Nick Gillespie.
That's right. Just Gillespie.
The axiomatic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mononym known as Gillespie.
That's right.
Yeah.
Do you have any pressure at Fox to not to be too anti-Trump or anything?
No,
like
they're
that?
Really good about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the pressure doesn't come from within. The anger comes from out there. Yeah. When, you know, it's like when I say something anti-Trump or say something that's the actual truth or data-driven, then people are like, you're anti-MAGA and you should be canceled and I'm never watching when you're on ever again. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you will, Grandpa. Just take some Relaxium. You'll be there for me. I'll say something nice about Tiffany Trump and you'll be like, you're a patriot.
How do you prepare for today's politics? We should talk about politics all the time.
Yeah.
And today's politics are insane. And the only thing we know is they're not as bad as tomorrow's will be.
Yes.
What kind of drugs are you taking, I guess is what I'm asking.
Not as many as I should.
Yeah.
You know, it's the damn fentanyl. Mm. It used to be you could go get a bump and a martini at lunchtime, but boy, they've really thrown a wet blanket on that yard party. I try and read. I obviously read the Daily Mail.
Yeah,
and
where you're a columnist.
Yes, and
what's your latest column as
about Brigitte Macron being a pedophile?
Okay, yeah, but she is a woman.
She's totally. Okay. She's like so womanly.
Yeah. Okay,
and so she was like,
you're not chasing that. What do you mean that she's a pedophile?
Well, she groomed a 15-year-old boy, and then his parents were like,
"That's going to be pedophilia."
Sacre bleu.
Yeah,
but it's funny because, like, all these Gen Z French kids are reading this stuff. Like, what? She was 39 and he was 15. Yeah. And then his parents are like, this is super gross. We're taking you out of school and you're going to finish high school in Paris. And she was like, well, I think I could find myself free on the weekends to do your laundry. And
it's a weekend.
she would yeah. follow him on the weekends.
Yeah.
Where they would play hide the sausage.
Is it, is that a, what's the import of that in contemporary America?
And I think she's their Mary Kay Letourneau.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Do people remember Mary Kay Letourneau? Yeah.
She was a middle school teacher who raped her 11-year-old student and got pregnant with two of his daughters in prison. Yeah. One of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you miss that America?
I was living in Seattle at the time. Yeah. And one year for Halloween, I went as Mary Kay Letourneau.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
And I made my then boyfriend dress up as Willy Falau in overalls with a lunch pail and little freckles on his nose.
They're no longer together, right?
She's no longer living.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that would be a problem.
Yeah.
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 So I guess as a final question before we go to audience Q&A, what's next for Kennedy? What do you think is the big story or insight or attitude that we need to cultivate over the next year or so to make for a better America?
I think for a better America, we should all try to get rad and not give a shit. Mm. Like, I think if most people did that, everything would be just fine.
Yeah.
I truly, truly believe that. And like, people are like, what's getting rad? It's like, just go out there and find out. Just go do some cool shit. Like, have some fun. Challenge yourself. Do something you've never done. Go somewhere you've never gone. Like, don't worry about what people think of you. Just go get rad. And then when people think worse of you, tell them to fuck off. Like, just stop giving a shit about what other people think and say about you. And it is the most freeing and wonderful thing in the world, because then you won't give a shit about other people, meaning you're not going to judge them. And when we don't judge each other, we are much more likely to flourish. And then other people can get rad, and then we can all high-five each other and celebrate what should be the Gen X golden years.
All right. That's spoken. It's like you were channeling... Madame Macron right there.
Yes, right? That's right.
Hello, my name is Brigitte.
I don't believe that old Candace Owens thing's like, she's got three kids who look exactly like her.
Yeah. All right. Do you worry, one last question.
Before the last question? Yeah.
No, you're making me think of Tucker Carlson, a former Fox News heavyweight. Who clearly believes every conspiracy that comes down the line. Is there, do you worry about that virus taking over your brain?
My personal brand, no.
Yeah.
I think conspiracy theories are fun.
Yeah.
I very much believe in Bigfoot, and no one will ever talk me down from that ledge.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of stuff I'm like, no, that's just made up. That's just, you know, that's just laziness. You're not adequately trying to investigate something and you can't accept that sometimes we just don't know the answer. And that's sad for us, and maybe at some point we will.
Yeah.
And then I asked ChatGPT, if we're going to be best friends forever. And ChatGPT says, fuck yeah. And then I feel better about everything.
All right. We're going to leave it there. We've been talking to Kennedy. Thank you so much.